Now, brethren, I don't know if you're aware, if you've checked your email this morning, but I did send out some slides today, and they will be part of the message. So if you haven't retrieved them, you may want to do so. I'm going to display them on our TV here, so it's easier for everyone here to see. So if you want to retrieve those, please do that now, because they will be part of the message. Okay, brethren, so today we're going to continue on in Daniel chapter 2, but we'll do a quick recap since, believe it or not, it's been 5 weeks since I last spoke. So in chapter 1 in Daniel, we saw that King Nebuchadnezzar became king at a very young age, the age of 25, upon the death of his father. And as one of his first acts as king, he seized Jerusalem. He became the greatest king of the time and had a world-ruling empire. He makes Jehoiakim his vassal, supplanting Egypt's hold on him, and Jehoiakim's subservience to Babylon begins with this first siege. Upon King Nebuchadnezzar laying down his terms for tribute and servitude, God offers Jehoiakim a way out through the prophet Jeremiah. This was a chance to prevent the curses clause of the covenant from kicking in. Jehoiakim, in his hubris, knew better. He does not obey the voice of the Lord, and he plows on ahead with his own agenda. An agenda, as history will show us, cost him his life, that ended his life in disgrace, and ultimately furthered the downfall of the nation of Judah. Thankfully, God was on his throne, and while delivering on his promise of calamity, God had raised up 4 young men whose service and example furthered the preparation of nations, of the world, and especially for the coming of Christ and the latter days. Now, as we're about to shift to chapter 2, there are a couple of loose ends that need to be tied up from chapter 1. And when you continue to study and review some of the previous material that you've gone over, sometimes you can see discrepancies that you'd previously overlooked. And at no point should we ever think we have it all down pat. I often think that I'm only scratching the surface. When more information comes to light, we need to square it against the scriptures to see if it's true, which makes Bible study very humbling, and I believe as it should be. So I stand before you, and I confirm that the more you read and study and contemplate God's holy word, the more you realize how little you know. Reading and rereading is such a powerful way to meditate on what God is saying, and he always seems to be saying a lot. So let's attempt to clear up the discrepancies. So the first discrepancy is, depending on the translation you may have in front of you, Daniel 1:5 reads, "And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacy and of wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them," which is what I read, "so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king." Now, believe it or not, looking into the Aramaic, the verse does not say train for 3 years. It actually says nourish for 3 years. And in the context of food, that makes sense. Now, why is this important? Well, it presents another mathematical issue for us with determining when King Nebuchadnezzar began to reign. Now, I don't want to bore you with all the details again, but suffice to say that it makes Daniel chapter 1 verse 18 and Daniel chapter 2 verse 1 hard to explain. And I'll explain. Let's read Daniel 1:18, those two verses. Daniel 1:18 and Daniel 2 verse 1. Daniel 1:18 reads, "Now at the end of days when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them before Nebuchadnezzar." And Daniel 2 verse 1 says, "Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him." It's only the first part of that verse I want. "In the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign." So what's happened here is that if you read 3 years of training into Daniel 1 verse 5, then Daniel 1 verse 18 and Daniel 2 cannot possibly be accurate. How can we fit 3 years into a single year? Because that, the first act in his first year was to siege Jerusalem, and then chapter 2 opens with "in the second year of his reign." And again, you can't fit 3 years into 1 year, and I know that's no surprise to you. So the scholars have come up with an idea that King Nebuchadnezzar ruled alongside his father for a period of a few years, and that term is co-regent. And Daniel 2, verse 1 was actually, again, the second year then they predict or put forth their theory that it was the second year of ruling on his own. And I admit I cannot prove or disprove that. I have searched, and nor can I find any credible information to actually support that claim. So at this point, it's a guess. Educated is a loose word if we say an educated guess. We use that loosely. Now I ask a question to you. What if you only had the Bible in front of you to read from and not even be able to look at man's recorded history? How would we reconcile this? Well, the simplest answer I can look at is that Daniel 1:5 again does not mean 3 years of training, but instead 3 years of nourishing or feeding them. So when verse 18 records that their time was finished and they were presented to King Nebuchadnezzar, it is possible that the four boys had completed the academic portion of their training, but they had not finished eating yet. So the second point then we'll move on to has to do with the last verse of chapter 1. And it reads in Daniel 1:21. It says, "And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus." This verse is also a time marker that we should dig a little bit. And what needs to be addressed is it basically gives us an understanding of how long Daniel served under the kings. Now the verse says Daniel reigned until the first year of King Cyrus. But if you turn to Daniel chapter 10 and verse 1, Daniel chapter 10 and verse 1, it says, "In the third year of King Cyrus," in the year of Cyrus, king of Persia, "this thing was revealed unto Daniel." So we can see that at least until the third year, Daniel was around and serving King Cyrus. So again, King Nebuchadnezzar, just to give you a time marker, King Nebuchadnezzar ascended to the throne in 605 BC. And King Cyrus became king in 539 BC. And that places then King Cyrus's third year of reign at 536 BC. Now to do some quick math, from the beginning of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar until the last, or at least the third year, of King Cyrus, we can figure that Daniel lived almost through the entire 70 years of captivity. Now there's no indication of how Daniel dies in this book or anywhere else in the Bible. All we are told was Daniel was instructed to go thy way, Daniel. And you can find that in Daniel chapter 12. So is it possible that Daniel died before the Jews were liberated through Nehemiah back to Jerusalem? It is possible. And with those put to bed, let's move on now to Daniel chapter 2 and continue our verse-by-verse study. And we'll see Daniel's first big test arrives with the dream of King Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2. So we're going to start in Daniel chapter 2, verse 1. "Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king." Verse 3, "And the king said to them, I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. And then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, saying, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation." They must have misheard, right? Naturally, King Nebuchadnezzar would tell them the dream. Verse 5, "King Nebuchadnezzar answered to the Chaldeans. He said, My decision is firm." In the verbiage of modern-day baseball, strike one. "If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made an ash heap." So in case you were wondering, or in case they were wondering, King Nebuchadnezzar wasn't playing around. This was an impossible situation that meant certain death for all the magicians, the astrologers, and the sorcerers. And I've read this chapter at least a dozen times or so, and while preparing this message, I have to admit that the more I read it, the more I see a king who's becoming unbalanced and self-absorbed. Verse 6, "However, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation." Verse 7, they answered again and said, "Let the king tell his servants that the dream, and we will give its interpretation." We can't understand their tone when they're saying this just by reading these words. But they must have been thinking, do you hear yourself? You're asking something that's never been asked. Did they even think it was a game? I doubt it. Verse 8, and the king answered and said, I know for certain that you would gain time, because you see that my decision is firm. Second time he uses it, strike 2. King Nebuchadnezzar's response gives us a small view into the character of these men. They were trying to stall, and frankly, who could blame them? King Nebuchadnezzar declares a second time that my decision is firm, and they must have become desperate. Verse 9, and if you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you, for you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time is changed. Therefore, tell me my dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. Verse 10, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. Brethren, that's probably the truest thing those guys ever said. You don't have to turn there if you don't want to, but I think it draws our attention to Luke chapter 18, verse 27. Luke 18, verse 27, where it's recorded Christ's words, but he said, the things which are impossible with men are possible with God. Back to Daniel chapter 2, verse 11. It says, it is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there's no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. So now, brethren, it's very evident they understood what was being asked, and I believe they answered this question again as honestly as they could. No man could do this. Verse 12, for this reason the king was angry and very furious and gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. Strike 3, brethren. King Nebuchadnezzar has all the power as he sits atop a world-ruling empire. Who can challenge or question his judgment? No one. Verse 13, so the decree went out and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. So here we are in a frantic scene. The killing's begun, and they were coming for Daniel and the boys. Now let's set the scene. We have Daniel, who's still a teenager, and he's going to go and talk to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard. The captain of the king's guard is a polished way of saying that he was basically tasked with executing whom the king told him to execute. Another, instead of calling him captain of the guard, he is the king's executioner. This man literally decided whether or not Daniel lived or died, as well as the other magicians and astrologers. Daniel then meets and talks with Arioch. Verse 14 of Daniel chapter 2. Then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. This was a risky and a bold move. Now Daniel was being very smart when he went about his conversation with extreme prudence. His words were measured and with wisdom. And it should remind us as well of Proverbs chapter 15, verses 1 and 2, if you'll turn there. Proverbs 15, verses 1 and 2. And this is a lot easier to do when you're not in the hostile situation. When you're in a hostile situation, this isn't as easy. Proverbs 15, 1 and 2 says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise uses knowledge rightly, but the mouth of fools pours forth foolishness. So these two verses capture that Daniel realized what he was up against, and a negative reaction or a carelessly spoken word would result in certain death for him and his friends. Thus, his only option was to answer very carefully. Verse 15. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree from the king so urgent? And then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. So here he is, the king's executioner, actually taking the time to explain King Nebuchadnezzar's decree to a teenager. That should give us an indication of how well-respected Daniel was. Near the end of chapter 1, all four young men were stated as being gifted by God with knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. Yet Daniel is singled out as being gifted in dreams and visions. And I wonder if he knew that, or if this verse is just stating that God gave him the gifts unaware. My opinion is that he knew God gave him the gift of interpreting dreams. And I believe the next verse proves this. Daniel 2:16. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. Now, if you're familiar with the book of Esther, there was no person that was allowed in the inner court of the king without being invited. Okay? So let's turn to Esther 4, verse 11, just to show this. Esther 4, verse 11. If you're looking for Esther, it's just after Nehemiah. Okay. Esther chapter 4, verse 11. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death, except the one whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. That was Esther speaking. So I will qualify that this verse is 120 years or so later than Daniel standing here before King Nebuchadnezzar. And this kingdom was an extension of Babylon. So it's very possible this goes back all the way to Babylon. The point I'm trying to make, brethren, is going in before the king was serious business. And Arioch was not protesting. And to think about that, because even his life may have been in danger by allowing this to happen. Daniel was evidently held in high esteem by King Nebuchadnezzar as well, because he was permitted access to the king's presence, and he was able to petition the king directly. So again, a person does not approach the king's palace and get FaceTime with the king. Another bold move. But it would likely have made a big impression on King Nebuchadnezzar, because the king agrees to give Daniel time. This was a miracle from God, because the decree had already gone out to begin killing the wise men, and King Nebuchadnezzar paused the action until Daniel had time. So how does Daniel react to being given time? Well, he hightails it home and he tells Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or if you like it better, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he has a conversation that was likely urgent and succinct. This was literally life and death. And faced with life and death, what did they all do? Let's read Daniel chapter 2, verse 17. Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek the mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So they went and they sought out the mercies of God so that they might not perish with the rest of the wise men. Please keep in mind that they were just young men at most. And they prayed in faith and asked God for protection and deliverance. This example should be not lost on us either, brethren. Regardless of our age, as we are seeing the world around us change in ways that seem like they are straight out of a movie or a novel, we too must seek the mercies of God. When things are beyond our control, we have to look to God. And thankfully, we can go to God and petition Him for those very same mercies. Daniel chapter 2, verse 19. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. This is evidence that God answers prayer. Their lives would be spared. The secret was revealed. Another example in action for us to learn from and incorporate in our very own lives, brethren. When God answers our prayers, from a small matter to a life and death matter, we must be grateful and praise our God for His patience, His love, and His mercy equally. Let's read Daniel's prayer of gratitude to God. Daniel chapter 2, verse 20. And Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are His. And He changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with Him." Verse 23, "And I thank You and praise You, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have made known to me what we asked of You. For You have made known to us the king's demand." Everything that Daniel had, brethren, came from God. Absolutely everything. Notice that at the end of verse 23, Daniel remarks that they all asked God to reveal the secret to Daniel. And with this understanding in hand, Daniel immediately rose, went to Arioch, as there was no time to waste. And these next few verses are very inspiring, brethren, because they highlight Daniel's bold faith in action. Daniel chapter 2, verse 24. Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. And he went and said thus to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation." Please don't gloss over the significance that a Jewish captive comes before the king's executioner and commands him not to destroy the wise men of Babylon. And the king's executioner listens. Daniel's not finished, though. He then demands that Arioch take him before the king, pointing back to Esther. This was not a simple just open the door and walk right in. Daniel, a prisoner of war, demanded to be brought before the most powerful man in the world at the time. Brethren, it was God that was opening the doors. Verse 25, then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said to him, "I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation." Brethren, Arioch wasted no time, so he listened and did exactly as Daniel had demanded. And I wonder if this was a humbling admission that it was a captive of Judah. Verse 26, and the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation?" Now we're only able again to read the words on the page. And the fact that King Nebuchadnezzar asks Daniel if he could actually make known the dream, I ponder and I wonder if King Nebuchadnezzar was actually skeptical. Maybe so. Daniel 2:27. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king." So here we are. Daniel essentially confirms what the other astrologers and magicians and soothsayers were saying. This was an impossible ask because they were men. And brethren, I honestly think Daniel is actually lumping himself in there when he talks about the wise men. So he's putting himself in the very same boat. Then he says in verse 28, "But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what it will be like in the latter days." So not right then and there, brethren, but in the latter days. "Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these." So Daniel gives God the credit, so King Nebuchadnezzar does not think Daniel is worthy of the credit. So the most powerful empire under the direction that subjugated the Jewish nation as his vassal, it's their God, the God of those captives. But he adds that it's the God of heaven, the God of the Jews, it's the God of Israel that can make the dream and its interpretation known to him. Verse 29. "As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what you would what would come to pass after this, and he would reveal secrets that is made known to you what will be. But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes to make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart." Daniel's saying that there's nothing special about him. This is all about God, the true revealer of dreams. And brethren, that's actually the role of a prophet. The role of the prophet is to point you to God. So the revealing of the dream was to the benefit of Daniel and the boys, as well as to the benefit of King Nebuchadnezzar himself. Verse 31, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. The image's head was of fine gold, its chest of arms and silver, its belly and thighs of bronze." So just an interjection. Head is the fine gold, chest and arms are silver, belly and thighs are bronze. Verse 33, "Its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay." So again, the top part of the legs, if you can see different images that people have created, it's only the thighs, the top part of the legs, which are actually bronze, and it's the lower half of the leg below the knee that are iron, and the feet are iron mixed with clay. Verse 34, Daniel 2:34. "You watched while a stone was cut out with hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces." Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. Now just a small interjection here, brethren. Notice that Daniel says, we will tell the interpretation. And I have read that that applies also to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Yet, they are standing with Daniel to explain the dream first off. And brethren, only Daniel is given the secret of the dream, as we read in verse 23. So could Daniel be given the credit to God that he was effectively the conduit or the mouthpiece to deliver the interpretation? I believe that's a legitimate possibility. Daniel chapter 2, verse 37. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you kingdom, power, strength, and glory. This God of heaven is being given credit that King Nebuchadnezzar is only a king of kings. Right? King Nebuchadnezzar is not the king of kings. That title, brethren, is reserved for Jesus Christ. Verse 38. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand, and he has made you ruler of them all. You are this head of gold. So the dream starts off quite favorably. Nebuchadnezzar, you are this head of gold. Did King Nebuchadnezzar's pride swell? Or was he sitting on the edge of his throne, hanging on every word Daniel spoke? Verse 39, but after you shall arise another kingdom, inferior to yours. Then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes that kingdom, will break in pieces and crush all the others. Now whereas you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. Verse 42. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. Daniel 2, verse 43. And as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. Verse 44. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. The very same God that made the dream and its interpretation known to Daniel, and by extension King Nebuchadnezzar, is the very same God of heaven that will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and it shall stand forever. It will not be turned over to a human ruler, implying that it will be ruled by God himself. In verse 45, inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. So here the Jewish captive boldly asserts before the king that the dream is certain and the interpretation is sure. God is removing any option for King Nebuchadnezzar to throw up his hands and state that he is ignorant. Verse 46. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. And the king answered Daniel and said, truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings and the revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. King Nebuchadnezzar's action of prostrating himself before Daniel was definitely an act of humility, and he recognizes that Daniel's God is the Lord of kings. He is supreme. But sadly, King Nebuchadnezzar is pretty hard-headed, and this humility will not last long, as we shall see when we get into the next chapter next time. Verse 48, then the king promoted Daniel and gave him great gifts, and it made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. And also Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. So Daniel was promoted for the benefit of all of God's people, and like a loyal friend, Daniel does not forget his friends, and he petitions that they too benefit from their heartfelt prayers and God's intervention, which they were rewarded. Now, brethren, that marks the end of the chapter. But as we conclude, I'd like to go back now and take a closer look at the four empires that are depicted in the different medals of the statue of Daniel chapter 2. Now, it's without question who the first three kingdoms or empires are. And as we begin reviewing the four empires, some may be wondering, what impact does this have on my life since it's history? Well, it was history that's not complete. The old saying in the church is, prophecy is nothing more than history in advance. And maybe your go-to or your jam is Christian Living Messages, and that's great. But we need to remember that God gave us from Genesis to Revelation for many, many reasons. And I'd like to read one reason that's captured by the Apostle Peter. Please turn in your Bible to 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3. And we'll read verse 2. 2 Peter 3 verse 2. It reads, verse 2, that ye may be mindful of the words which were spoken before the holy prophets, and of the commandment of us and the apostles of the Lord and Savior. How mindful are we of the words spoken by the holy prophets? And Daniel, brethren, is one of those holy prophets. A goal of this study is to increase our mindfulness. Now, it's important to have a flexible approach to prophecy. And I'm not saying, though, being swayed by every wind of doctrine. Instead, what I'm saying is we cannot have tunnel vision. We are told right in the text that King Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold. King Nebuchadnezzar was the ruler of Babylon, the second kingdom to come along and absorb, and absorb the territory of Babylon. And that kingdom was the Medo-Persian Empire, which was inferior to Babylon, as depicted in the metal of silver. The third king to come after the Medo-Persian Empire was that of Greece. Then the fourth kingdom that comes along has believed and has been taught to be Rome. Is Rome the fourth kingdom? It's a valid question, since this doctrine has been taught in the worldwide Church of God for more than 80 years. And I'd like to present an alternative view. One that I think has merit. Now, I'm not trying to convince you of something. I will let you decide what you think is true. I will confess, though, at this point in time, I'm keeping all the options open. I'm not willing to put all my eggs in a single basket, and thus I'm not going to be afraid to explore other options and test them against the scriptures. We need to be Berean-like and search the scriptures daily to see if these things are so. Now, what struck me was a statement made when we were at the feast a couple of years ago in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. One of the seminars, and they had seminars daily, one of the seminars that were given was given by a church member who in fact was actually a minister. And he was named Tony Bosserman. And he has his own radio program, interestingly enough, in Sacramento, California, called Original Christianity. And it's on the radio every Sabbath morning on KFIA, 710 AM, The Word. So I went and looked him back up again. In his seminar, he mentioned that he was looking at where we are in prophecy, and he was commenting on the church's long-held position that the fourth king in Daniel's vision cannot be Rome. And the number of voices in the church today, brethren, repeating this same doubt is growing. Now, I'm not sure if you are aware of the church's position, whether you're young or how long you've been in the church, but I've captured a few quotes from Mr. Armstrong, from as early as 1938. And I'm doing this to show you where his thinking was coming from. And it will be evident that the First and the Second World Wars influenced his thinking greatly, and who could blame him? Hopefully you have it in front of you. The first slide, which should have some quotes and a picture of Mr. Armstrong. Okay, so the first quote, and I'm just going to read them as you see them on your page. Mussolini and the Pope will hatch up an idea between them, setting up a world headquarters at Jerusalem. And so Mussolini's armies will enter Palestine, Daniel 11:41, and eventually will capture half the city of Jerusalem. And that comes from the March 1938 Plain Truth magazine. Second quote, Mussolini's soon appearing reborn Roman Empire is the beast power, and Mussolini undoubtedly is the beast. Undoubtedly, then the beast who will be fighting at Armageddon against Christ is Mussolini, with 10 European dictators and their armies. It's coming in this generation. That was January 1939, so that's 9 months before the start of the Second World War. Third quote, Hitler now emerges as the beast of Revelation, May and June. 1941 Plain Truth, so that changed a bit, and that's okay. Adolf Hitler probably is still alive today. Evidence piles up that he is this minute secretly directing the powerful Nazi underground. August 1952, Plain Truth magazine. Now again, brethren, just to be clear, I'm not bringing that up to mock or do anything of that nature. I'm just trying to again show where his head was at, where his thinking. And again, who could blame him for thinking, especially what he lived through? Now, most in this room, except for the youth, are likely familiar with the idea of a revived Holy Roman Empire, or United States of Europe, rising up. This empire will be led by Germany, who will be the political beast, who will then lead 10 nations and link up with the Roman Catholic Church, the Pope being the false prophet. Does this view hold up against a scriptural litmus test? I know that is a bold statement. Let's examine this doctrine, this teaching, and let's be honest with the scriptures, and let's see where the chips fall. Now, this idea that the fourth kingdom of iron, as a reference to Rome, may go back further than most realize. The worldwide Church of God was not the first and may explain why Rome was chosen as the understanding of the fourth kingdom. In fact, around 200 AD, Hippolytus, the bishop of Rome, stated, "The legs of iron expressed the Romans, who hold sovereignty at the moment." The next person to come along and suggest Rome was Jerome, who wrote the Latin Vulgate. He was hugely influential, and in his commentary in 408 AD, he says, "Now the fourth empire, which clearly refers to the Roman, is the iron empire which breaks in pieces and overcomes all others." Even Martin Luther and John Calvin in the Reformation joined the chorus of those before them that the fourth empire was Rome. Looking in my Bible study software, the commentaries that address this kingdom all seem to agree that this kingdom represented Rome. Now let's review, and we have some slides here as well, if you still... We have the image, which is the second slide. So you see, gold is Babylon, which is, so you're aware, is modern-day Iraq. Today, mostly Muslim. Silver, Persia, is modern-day Iran. In fact, it was still called Persia until 1935. Bronze, the belly and the thighs of brass, are Greece under Alexander. His empire, while smaller than Persia, stretched from the western side of India into Macedonia and down into Egypt. Today, these nations are mostly Muslim. Iron. Let's leave iron blank for now and see what fills it in. And the stone, the last mineral or ore in the vision, represents Jesus' return and the establishment of the kingdom of God. Now, as we explore this, we need to start with an Aramaic word. And the Aramaic word is, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, dekaq. D-E-Q-A-Q. D-E-Q-A-Q. And it's Strong's number 1855. This word appears 10 times. And since it's Aramaic, it's only in the book of Daniel. The word appears 6 times in chapter 2 alone. And let me say that this word is very important, if not critical, to our litmus test. Dekaq is often translated, breaks in pieces, or to crush. It means to pulverize, to smash, to smithereens. Let's go back now to Daniel chapter 2, verse 34 and 35, which is the first locations to where this word is used. So Daniel chapter 2, verses 34 and 35. Here, Daniel 2:34 reads, "You watched while the stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces." Broke them here is dekaq. Verse 35, Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together. That's dekak, crushed together. And became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So we know the stone is Jesus Christ. And when in conjunction with verse 35, so verse 34 in conjunction with verse 35, we can see that this breaking in pieces and crushing them together is so thorough and complete that there is no trace of the other four kingdoms left at all. To the point that the stone becomes a great mountain and fills the whole earth. This is the kingdom of God. And there's no dispute on that. We'd all agree with that. Let's go now, jump down to verse 44 and 45. Daniel 2, 44 and 45. Daniel 2, 44 says, "And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall be not left to other people, and it shall break in pieces, dekak, and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever." Verse 45, "Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces, dekak again, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure." So again, brethren, there is no disagreement that the kingdom of God will utterly crush and smash to oblivion any man-made kingdom. The kingdom of God will fill the whole earth, meaning it will be the only kingdom on this earth, and it will stand forever. Now let's go back to verse 40. Daniel chapter 2, verse 40. "And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, and inasmuch iron breaks in pieces, dekak, and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, the kingdom will break in pieces and crush," again, dekak, "all the others." So the fourth kingdom, the iron kingdom, will break in pieces and crush all the others. Now, for the irreparable complication of the fourth kingdom being Rome. Are you ready, brethren? Rome never did this. Rome never crushed into pieces all the other kingdoms before it. Rome never conquered Persia. In fact, militarily, the terrain of Persia did not work for their style of warfare. They would have lost legions of soldiers in the mountains of Iran. Never pulverized. Rome never pulverized Alexander's Greek Empire. Rome certainly defeated them militarily, but they did not crush and pulverize their literature, their philosophy. Rome consequently loved these aspects of the Greek culture and syncretized them into their own culture, language, and religion, which is a very Roman thing to do, to syncretize. The Roman Empire was not in the same location as these earlier three empires of the gold, the silver, and the bronze. The Roman Empire is a European empire, not a Middle Eastern empire, as the three previous empires all were. Lastly, the Roman military approach to their conquest was basically to leave the countries largely as they were. So again, they would defeat them militarily, but as we see in the Gospels, the Romans basically demanded taxes of the Jews and loyalty to Caesar and let them rule themselves. So filtering the conquests of Rome through the dekak filter of Daniel chapter 2 results in Rome failing a biblical test. If you want to use Daniel 2 as your grounds for a 10-nation European beast, I submit to you it's not a very strong position. History shows that the Islamization of Iran occurred as a result of the Muslim conquest of Persia. Islam defeated Persia and swallowed up the entire Middle East. It destroyed existing religions, culture, and language, even the alphabet. Islam pulverized everything in its path. This is the very same promise that Islam makes today. Now, where else in the Bible does the idea of Rome come into the picture? Let's turn over to Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17. We're going to read four verses. verses 6 through 9. Revelation 17, verses 6 through 9. Verse 6 says, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. But the angel said to me, Why do you marvel? Why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has seven heads and ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. And when we see the beast that was and is not, and yet is. Verse 9. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. So here we read, the seven heads are seven mountains. Rome is a city of seven hills. So the harlot is based in Rome, which we then have associated over the decades in the church that represents the Vatican. In the booklet, Who is the Antichrist? Referring to Revelation 17:9, Garner Ted Armstrong wrote, Notice the incontrovertible evidence of her location. And here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. Rome is famous for its seven hills. Rome calls itself the Eternal City. A further quote, This can only be said of one city. It is so-called Eternal City. Sadly, brethren, that statement is patently false. If you look on Wikipedia, there are many, many cities, almost 90, that are built on seven hills. And some, in fact, predate Rome. I'll give you a few. Shimla, India. Amman, Jordan. Jerusalem. Mecca, Saudi Arabia. Tehran, Iran. And Athens, Greece, just to name a few. And those are, again, the ones that predate Rome. You can have others. Even Liverpool is said to be built on seven hills. Now, verse 9, again, says mountains and not hills. The Greek word for hill and the Greek word for mountain are different. And I'll show you in a single verse where they're used. Luke chapter 3, verse 5. Go back to the Gospels, to chapter Luke. The book of Luke, chapter 3, verse 5. Verse 5 says, Every valley shall be filled, and every mountain and hill brought low. The crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough ways smooth. Strong's 3735, Oros, O-R-O-S, means mountain. Strong's 1015 is Bonos, B-O-U-N-O-S, N-O-S, and that means hill. Brethren, Rome was not built on seven mountains, but seven hills. Revelation 17:9 is saying that the woman sits on seven heads, which are seven mountains. Biblically, mountains are figuratively used to represent kingdoms. Rome fails this biblical test also. But as we look in our world today to reflect back on history at the same time, what is probably the greatest threat to the world today? It's radical Islam or Islamic Jihad. Now, I don't know if you were paying attention this summer, but a very significant event happened in Istanbul, Turkey. The Hagia Sophia, if you've heard of it, was converted back into a mosque. Now, what's so significant about the Hagia Sophia? Well, first off, it's one of the titles of Jesus Christ, holy or divine wisdom. I'm going to give a little history for those who may be unaware. In 537 AD, the Hagia Sophia was completed under the direction of the Byzantine Emperor Justinian I. A cathedral to Christianity it was, a jewel in the crown of Christianity, and was one of the most beautiful buildings in the world at the time. Almost 1,000 years later, 900 and some years later, in 1453 AD, Constantinople fell to the Ottoman Turks. After Sultan Mehmed II conquered Constantinople, in 1453, he designated the structure as a mosque. Hagia Sophia was converted to a mosque and dedicated to Allah. It would remain a mosque, basically, until being converted into a museum in 1935. And it was currently a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The Ottoman Empire is described as the Islamic superpower. and it ruled from 1299 AD to 1923. That's just over 700 years. In 1922 and in 1923, the Ottoman Empire was mortally wounded. It died just after the First World War, after the British defeated it. And as of 1923, Turkey became a secular republic. The Islamic Caliphate was dead and finished in 1924. The current president of Turkey, and I hope I say his name correctly, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has publicly stated that he plans to resurrect and revive the Ottoman Empire. Erdogan called, "Democracy is like a streetcar. You ride it until you get to where you need to be, and then you get off." He further stated, "The resurrection of the Hagia Sophia heralds the liberation of the Al-Aqsa Mosque that is in Jerusalem." And in order to do so, that means that the Muslims would have to drive the Jews out of Jerusalem. "The resurrection of the Hagia Sophia is the footsteps of the will of Muslims across the world to come out of the interregnum." And that word means the gap. The gap between 1923 and basically the not too distant future. So on July 24th, 2020 this year, the first time in 85 years, Muslim prayers were conducted. Now the Hagia Sophia is officially now called the Hagia Sophia Holy Grand Mosque and formerly the Church of the Hagia Sophia. And that's right off their webpage. Turn with me, if you would, to Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13. We're just going to read the first three verses, Revelation 13, verses 1 to 3. John writes, "And then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on the horns ten crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave his power, his throne, and great authority." Verse 3, "And I saw one of the heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and the wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast." Now, brethren, in the slides, if you want to look real close, I have a slide of the first kingdom of Babylon. So you can see exactly the territory it covered. So Egypt, what is Israel, Syria, Turkey, part of Turkey today, Iraq, and a portion of Iran. The second kingdom, this is the Medo-Persian Empire. You can see that it stretched as far as India to the east, and it came all the way across to the west into Greece, into Macedonia, and then it went down into Egypt, a Middle Eastern Empire. Kingdom number three, this is Alexander's kingdom. So again, Alexander's kingdom took everything that Persia had there, and again goes to the east as far as India. In the next slide, and it's cut off here, the Roman Empire at its height. Look at the location, brethren. It was a European empire, and it only had parts of North Africa and part into Asia Minor. It never conquered Persia, and it never went east of that. And now, the next slide, which is actually the Ottoman Empire. And you can see, it too is a Middle Eastern empire. And at its maximum area, as it says on the slide, it was 7.6 million square miles, or 19.9 million square miles in 1595. Now it shrunk through the years, it ebbed and flowed, but it shrunk to where, until it finally was ended in 1923. So, brethren, that's the slides. Now, only time will prove out which theory is correct, but Rome is looking less and less likely as it clearly does not fulfill the litmus test. So let's conclude, brethren, and wrap this up now. As we saw the interaction in chapter 2 between Daniel and King Nebuchadnezzar, we see that God used Daniel powerfully to make known the dream and its interpretation to the king, to King Nebuchadnezzar. This saved the lives of Daniel and the boys and furthered God's purpose in preparing history, not only for the first coming of Jesus Christ, but also for his second coming and the fulfillment of the end of the age. The interpretation of the dream needs to be evaluated firstly by the Holy Word of God and by conditions of the world today and if it still holds water. I presented both sides and you can decide for yourself. Let's conclude with asking a question based on that statement Daniel declared to King Nebuchadnezzar. And that statement is, the dream is certain and the interpretation is sure. What about us, brethren? What about us? Here we are some 2,500 years later. Do we believe that as well? Do we believe that the dream was certain and its interpretation is sure?